This is Ozarks at Large for Monday, June 23rd, 2014. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. The KUAF Summer Jazz Series welcomes the return of the Sons of Brasil, July 20th at 3 p.m. at 21C Hotel in Bentonville. The Sons of Brasil will perform jazz, samba, and bossa nova with a flavor and passion one might think could only be found at a nightclub in Brazil. This series is presented by the Northwest Arkansas Jazz Society. Tickets are available online at KUAF.com. Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, coverage from a groundbreaking ceremony for Bentonville's new high school. Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums attended the event earlier today and has a report. Plus, a conversation with the author of The Indicted South, Public Criticism, Southern Inferiority, and the Politics of Whiteness. Also, an update on an Arkansas gay marriage case filed last summer, the latest installment of Arkansongs, and more. But first, Arkansas's Democratic and Republican gubernatorial rivals are still at odds over what to do about the number of inmates in state prisons. Republican Asa Hutchinson and Democrat Mike Ross traded remarks over alternative sentencing for nonviolent offenders last week at the 80th convention of the Arkansas Municipal League. Ross pushed for reducing the number of incarcerated nonviolent drug offenders. Hutchinson characterized Ross's plan as lenient on nonviolent crime.
If somebody's home is burglarized, that's not a violent crime. But if they do it multiple times, then prison has to be a consequence. And so you just can't have a simplistic approach.
Ross said Hutchinson's portrayal of his plan to include allowing burglars and white-collar criminals out of prison is, quote, just plumb silly.
Does it really make sense that 52% of our prison population are folks that are there on nonviolent crimes? That does not mean that some nonviolent criminals do not need to be in prison. Of course they do. Particularly what I spoke to was about 42% of our inmates today are locked up on drug-related charges. I think if it's a first offense, what they really need is drug treatment.
Both gubernatorial candidates agree the state cannot continue to burden county jails with state inmates. Ross said an additional prison might be necessary, but only if it's tied to reforms, like adding job training programs for inmates. Hutchinson also said additional state prison beds are needed to relieve counties and to keep more people locked up who might otherwise be released early. Hutchinson argued against reforms, saying imprisonment itself could be useful in reforming behavior. Northwest Arkansas Regional Airport has a new master plan after the airport's board of directors approved the long-range planning document last week. Kelly Johnson, the executive director of XNA, says the main goal of the plan is to have a roadmap as airport officials move forward looking at specific planning periods.
We do an inventory and then do employment forecasts looking at the needs of the facilities, both land side and air side, going into a 5-year considered a short-term planning period, a 10-year which is considered midterm, and a 20-year planning period. So it gives us a good idea of the what-ifs of if traffic does this, we would need to look at these kinds of facilities and modifications, additions, deletions, that kind of thing.
Kelly says the last time the airport updated its master plan was in 2002.
Since then, we took a look at the old master plan and actually went through and highlighted the projects we had done in the 5- and 10-year planning periods, and then looked at the projects that weren't on the master plan that we had actually added. So it was time for an update. The facilities have grown a lot since 2002. We've added to the building multiple occasions, a lot of regulatory changes within the FAA and the other governing agencies which deal with the airport. So we needed to make some alignments to that existing plan.
Two of the biggest projects included in the updated master plan are a new access road and construction of a parking deck at the airport. We'll have more about the master plan on tomorrow's Ozarks at Large. A master plan of another sort is being developed in Bella Vista. Tomorrow night, the Bella Vista Property Owners Association and the Bella Vista Foundation will hold a public input meeting to develop a trails master plan within the city. Tom Pyatt is the president of the Bella Vista Foundation, and he says though Bella Vista was developed about a half century ago by Cooper Communities, now is the time to get serious about developing a comprehensive trail system.
Through that development and later years, there's been a number of trails incorporated within the village. But today's environment and today's population, through several different surveys that have been taken here in the last few years, there's really an obvious need for more trails and more walking, more recreation capabilities, including biking, hiking, running, jogging, etc. And also in the Northwest Arkansas community, there's been a significant effort here recently. An example is the 36-mile Razorback Trail that's almost complete now between Fayetteville and Bentonville.
He says a trail system in Bella Vista would connect to the Razorback Regional Greenway, likely continuing the trail nearly to the Missouri border. But that's just one part of a potential trail system.
It will have a corridor of trails and provide connectivity. We're talking about both the hard surface trails and soft surface trails, but very durable trails. And it'll be a comprehensive plan that covers the entirety of Bella Vista's 38,000 acres. We have about 600 miles of streets. Obviously, not all those streets need trails, but to weave through, to go through the entire village.
Pyatt says Alta Planning and Design, the group who has helped design the Razorback Greenway, is helping develop the Bella Vista Trails Master Plan. Development of the master plan has been funded by a grant to the Bella Vista Foundation from the Walton Family Foundation. The input meeting for the master plan will be held tomorrow from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. at Reardon Hall. A long-serving officer of the University of Arkansas Police Department will retire at the end of this month. Captain Vance Rice is the head of police services for UAPD, and during his 25 years with the department, he has worked as a patrol officer, criminal investigations lieutenant, and various other positions. Upon leaving June 30th, he will continue his law enforcement career as the chief of police at Mississippi State University. A routine bridge inspection will cause lane closures for the next few days in Fort Smith and Van Buren. According to the Arkansas Highway and Transportation Department, inspection of the Arkansas River Bridge on Highway 64 between the two cities will require closing the outside eastbound lane today and tomorrow, while the outside westbound lane will be closed Wednesday and Thursday. The closures will last between 9 a.m. and 3 p.m., weather permitting, and traffic will be controlled using barrels and warning signs. Beginning today in Fayetteville, part of Lafayette Street near the U of A campus will be closed. According to the city, the south side of Lafayette and the west side of Mock Avenue will be closed between 8 a.m. and 6 p.m. as crews relocate a water line. The work is expected to last through August 4th. The Northwest Arkansas Naturals will take 2 days off before beginning a road trip through Texas. Yesterday, the Nats ended their latest homestand with a 10-6 loss to Tulsa. The Nats will be back home on July 2nd. Tonight's weather forecast calls for mostly cloudy skies with a 60% chance of showers and thunderstorms and lows from 65 in northwest Arkansas to 69 in the Arkansas River Valley. Partly sunny tomorrow with a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms and highs around 85. Expect partly cloudy conditions tomorrow night with a slight chance of showers and lows from 66 to 69 degrees.
Someone just said, so we're going to, everybody grab a shovel on three. We're not only going to pick up the dirt, but audience, we want everybody to yell Wolverines at the end of that three as the dirt goes a-flying. So, on the count of three, one, two, three, Wolverines! Whoa! Okay, enjoy the music, enjoy each other, and thank you so much for being part of our grand opening.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. That was sound from today's groundbreaking ceremony for the new Bentonville High School in Centerton. Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums attended the event and is in Centerton with more on today's ceremony. Hello, Kyle.
Hello, Antoinette. Thank you very much. The ground was turned. I'm here with Michael Poore, the superintendent. And you mentioned the process that took place to get here. It was not always pleasant for everyone, passionate, sometimes contentious, but the end result is Bentonville West High School's groundbreaking has taken place.
Yeah, it's a really wonderful day. When you think of us having over 71 people percent of the community voted for this measure in a climate where things are still kind of tough and a little bit of an anti-tax sentiment, yet I think people believe that this is the right thing to do, and now it's our job to go produce a building that everybody will be proud of.
Right. So what happens beginning in a few hours from now?
We're going to dig dirt. We're going to dive in and get everything started going. And, you know, our plan is to obviously open in August of 2016, and that's an aggressive schedule. We're going to have to keep busy.
You mentioned collaborative space, that when this high school is done, that there will be unique ways of using space.
Absolutely. Everything from kids getting to see project-based labs to kids having space where they can actually do project work, you know, when they're not engaged in a classroom. So there's going to be so many neat opportunities for kids to be able to collaborate together and with teachers. I think it's going to be a hallmark of a design that others will probably want to replicate. It's the right thing to do for kids in this day and age.
You mentioned that between today's groundbreaking and the August 2016 grand opening, things will happen, decisions will have to be made, and you're just going to have to approach those head on.
Absolutely. We'll just, anytime you go move forward, whether it's on boundaries or whether it's on traffic, we'll just have to keep tackling that. But we've got great partners, whether it's within the city, the county, or our contractors that we work with. We'll just tackle them. And we've done that with our other buildings, and we'll do that with this one as well.
You know, we're talking about growth in Northwest Arkansas. And if you want to capture an image of what growth in Northwest Arkansas is, as we look, I guess we're looking south here, you see old barns and new housing developments in Suna High School here in Centerton. This was not that long ago a pretty rural stretch of land.
It really is. You know, you think about just how many things are going on, and what I hear from the mayor, there's probably 50 different housing units per month being asked for. So, you know, there's going to be even more growth now that this high school's coming in. And I think that, you know, when you look at just where are the dynamics of our district, this is really an ideal location for this building to be placed.
Finally, what are the challenges for a school district, and it's not unique to Bentonville and Northwest Arkansas, that are all growing, but growing so fast and the need for so many new facilities so quickly?
Well, you know, you're trying to use the public funds as best you can, but you don't want to, you know, go too much to the public. So one of the things we've already done is looking at when we get ready to build our next elementary school to do that on our dollar. And we hope to do that. That may happen as early as 2017 or 18. So, you know, we're not even, you know, ready to dig dirt yet, and we're already planning for our next school.
Keep those shovels?
Yeah, we're going to keep the shovels.
Michael Poore is the superintendent of Bentonville School District. Thank you so much for your
time. Thank you.
Appreciate
you being here.
All right, Antoinette, as you heard, there will be more growth in the Bentonville School District. From Bentonville, actually from Centerton, for Ozarks at Large, I'm Kyle Kellums.
Violinist Isabel Faust brings an exquisite interpretation to one of Bartok's most beloved pieces, his Violin Concerto No. 2. Hi, I'm Katie Henriksen, host of Note, Monday through Friday from 11 to noon on KUAF, as well as 6 p.m. weeknights on KUAF 2. Join me for that concerto from Isabel Faust on Tuesdays of Note. In her book, The Indicted South, Public Criticism, Southern Inferiority, and the Politics of Whiteness, Angie Maxwell analyzes the impact public criticism has had on the identity of white Southerners.
Being kind of cast as the, you know, the other in the American kind of story, or the exception, or the aberrant, you know, part of the country, has created those patterns of defensiveness. And I look specifically at the way in which it kind of creates a cultural kind of inferiority complex. And what you said about, you know, yourself feeling defensive, that's fine. You can feel defensive and you can manage those feelings of defensiveness. But there are groups and individuals who that really becomes so overwhelming that we see kind of a complex kind of arise. And that's when we see very irrational behavior.
That story's coming up in about 11 minutes on Ozarks at Large. First, Governor Mike Beebe weighs in on a special session and prepares for an overseas trade mission. Roby Brock from our content partner Talk Business and Politics has the details in his weekly business and political news update.
Governor Mike Beebe said he's not calling a special session on changes to the public school employee insurance program until he sees a roll call from each member of the legislature with a big majority in both. The governor also said he wants to deal with the prison overcrowding situation in a special session, and he's open to a provision to restrict lottery games. But beyond that, he does not anticipate adding to a special session agenda. Lawmakers are considering changes to the public school employees insurance fund, including the elimination of part-time employees from the plan, as well as spouses who have other insurance options. Also, lawmakers are talking about earmarking a portion of state funding that goes to general education needs, specifically to paying for insurance premiums. Governor Beebe will spend 9 days starting July 12th in London, Paris, and the Czech Republic as part of a European trade mission. Beebe's attending the London Farnborough Air Show, the largest air trade show in the world. Aerospace manufacturing is one of Arkansas's largest value-added exports. Beebe will also meet with new and existing economic development prospects in Paris and the Czech Republic. Beebe said the prospects are in the aerospace, auto supplier, and gun manufacturing industries. Arkansas lawmakers heard about the next wave of private option concepts that will be debated as the program moves forward this past week. The ideas include a version of health savings accounts, new cost-sharing measures, and a plan for non-emergency transportation needs for private option beneficiaries. Arkansas's private option takes federal Medicaid expansion dollars and uses it in private health insurance exchanges to subsidize lower-income workers' health care coverage. The General Assembly passed the program in 2013 and renewed funding in 2014. Ed Pinnock, former CEO of Worthen Bank and an inductee into the Arkansas Business Hall of Fame, was laid to rest Tuesday, June 17th, after services at Trinity Episcopal Cathedral in Little Rock. He was 92. Pinnock began working in 1948 for Worthen Bank, which had been founded by his maternal grandfather, William Worthen. His father, James Pinnock, was president. Ed Pinnock became president in 1961 at the age of 39, became CEO in 1966, and served as chairman of the board from 1974 to 1983. Pinnock was a 2005 inductee in the state's Business Hall of Fame. Finally, on the politics front, Asa Hutchinson and Mike Ross start their general election campaign for Arkansas governor with very healthy checkbook balances, but Ross leads in the cash-on-hand department. Ross had $1.6 million in the bank as of the end of May, while Hutchinson starts a general election with roughly $959,000 in cash, according to campaign finance reports. I'm Roby Brock, and that is your Talk Business and Politics update.
Support for Talk Business and Politics on Ozarks at Large is provided by AT&T. Challenging drivers to take the pledge to never text and drive. No text is worth the risk. More information at itcanwait.com. In early May, Arkansas's ban on same-sex marriage was struck down as unconstitutional. Hundreds of couples obtained wedding licenses before a stay was ordered by the Arkansas Supreme Court. Now, a second Arkansas gay marriage case, filed in U.S. District Court, is about to be considered. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports.
A year ago, June 26th, the U.S. Supreme Court found Section 3 of the Defense of Marriage Act unconstitutional, but left it up to states to legalize same-sex marriage. At the time, 38 states had bans in place against gay marriage. In response, dozens of attorneys across the U.S. filed a flurry of state and federal lawsuits challenging state prohibitions. One state lawsuit filed in Arkansas last summer has prevailed this past May when Pulaski County Circuit Court Judge Chris Piazza struck down Arkansas's ban. Within a week, the state Supreme Court issued a stay. In the interim, Piazza's decision led to the wedding licensure of more than 540 same-sex couples across the state. While their status remains in limbo, a second lawsuit filed last summer as well in federal court by Little Rock attorney Jack Wagner, the third, is about to come to life.
Basically held back on that case while we waited to see how the result was going to be in the state court case at the trial court level. We're hoping to move the federal court case forward and expect to be filing a motion for summary judgment in a federal court case within a couple of weeks.
U.S. District Judge Kristen Baker will hear the case in Little Rock in U.S. District Court, Eastern District of Arkansas. Wagner seeks declaratory judgment finding the state's constitutional ban on same-sex marriage in violation of the federal Constitution.
At this point, courts just aren't holding trials on these cases. They're ruling in favor of the plaintiffs.
There are over 70 marriage equality cases wending their way through the U.S. judicial system right now, and the landscape continues to shift. 45 cases are currently pending in federal courts, while 26 are pending in state courts. As of today, 29 states have either enacted marriage equality through legislation or the ballot, or had their state marriage ban struck down as unconstitutional. Jack Wagner also served as co-counsel on the prevailing circuit court case in Arkansas with Searcy County Attorney Cheryl Maples. Both lawyers are aiming to take down Arkansas's same-sex marriage prohibition, enacted through a 1997 statute and a 2004 voter-approved state constitutional amendment, because they say it violates guarantees of equal protection under state and federal constitutions. In his federal case, Wagner's suing a number of individuals on behalf of a half dozen same-sex plaintiffs.
All right, we've sued Larry Crane, who's the Pulaski County Circuit Clerk and the one charged with issuing marriage licenses in Pulaski County. We've sued Richard Weiss, W-E-I-S-S, as Director of the Arkansas Department of Finance and Administration, saying that he should allow joint tax returns to be filed by couples that are married in other states or people here that should be allowed to marry and file joint tax returns, and he should have to accept them. We filed on behalf of the Arkansas Teacher Retirement System because two of our people are married out of state, but their marriage is not recognized here. So the state of Arkansas doesn't recognize the spouse for purposes of spousal retirement benefits that go with the other spouse's retirement plan. And we have sued, we sued the Attorney General also in this case.
That would be Arkansas Attorney General Dustin McDaniel, who recently came out in support of same-sex marriage. But unlike other AGs who've refused to defend bans, he's chosen to fight to keep Arkansas's in place.
You know, the big thing in having a federal court decision is if the federal court for the Eastern District of Arkansas declares this unconstitutional, that's binding on all the state actors. Whereas the ruling by Judge Piazza, you know, is only going to apply to the specific plaintiffs that are involved in that case and the specific defendants that were ordered to do certain things, like, you know, Pulaski County Clerk was ordered to issue marriage licenses, and a couple other county clerks were, but the ones that weren't sued directly wouldn't be bound by his order. So, you know, it just gets a little piece of Arkansas, whereas a federal decision would be, you know, controlling over, you know, at least the Eastern District of Arkansas, but probably the whole state as far as what the state does.
Arkansas Supreme Court, which stayed Pulaski Circuit Judge Piazza's ruling, including the issuance of gay wedding licenses, will decide the merits of the case, likely this autumn, Wagner says. But if he wins his federal case, the state is expected to appeal to the Eighth Circuit Court in St. Louis, the first case of its kind to be heard there. And according to the record, that court may not be friendly towards gay civil rights, given that 8 years ago it reversed a lower court ruling striking down Nebraska's ban on same-sex marriage. In the meantime, five other federal appeals courts are presiding over 10 marriage equality cases in the coming weeks and months. Again, Little Rock attorney Jack Wagner.
You know, we're fixing to start getting some decisions from these federal circuit courts of appeals. The Sixth Circuit has already heard arguments on two cases. The Fourth Circuit has heard arguments on a case. You know, we ought to have decisions from these federal appeals courts coming out soon, and those are the courts right below the United States Supreme Court. And you know, hopefully those will keep rolling the same way. If they do, then it's going to be hard to see there being much that's likely to upset the trend in this area. If some of those buck the trend, then we'll just have to see what happens.
And if that happens, the ball will likely bounce back into the U.S. Supreme Court. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
The It is Monday, June 23rd, 2014, and this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda, and joining me now in Studio 123 is Becca Martin-Brown, Features Editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
I like this studio. It's fun.
It is a fun studio.
Plus, I've given her a whole bunch of stuff, so it's kind of like being at home. Speaking of being at home,
yes,
it's Art Center of the Ozarks musical time, but that has nothing to do with what's going on in the fall.
Okay.
They need some other music on the Art Center of the Ozarks stage besides what they produce. And so the serendipity season ends up being a lot of music.
Mm-hmm.
This year they tried something new, the Main Street Music Nights. And it
went
over really well. It was a chance to be up close and personal with the performers in the downstairs gallery in a very house concert kind of feel. So next year, the Main Street Music Nights will be August 8th, Music to Rob a Train By, An Evening with the Coverlets.
Oh.
It's a musician named Leo Mazow and Brittany Stevenson, and they do American folk rock and country.
You know, I think I heard them at a bar this summer out on a patio, and their voices were great.
Was it wonderful?
Their voices were really fun to listen to.
And then November 22nd is Brick Fields. They're awesome.
Of course.
January 10th is Walking the Line with Chris Cash. He played at the Wrecking Ball they had recently. And he does his own indie rock sound plus a lot of mashup stuff.
I missed him. Okay.
November 15th and May 2nd are the ACO Chorale concerts.
Mm-hmm.
And then December 7th and April 25th, the Arkansas Winds Community Concert Band concerts, both of which are traditions.
Yes.
And in between there, they will be having the Tales from the South on the Road with Paula Morrell back on March 15th.
Wonderful.
You can find out more about this by calling ACO, of course, at 751-5441. And there are all sorts of ticket packages so you can plan ahead.
Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin-Brown is Features Editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Mom hee-hawed. This was the punchline she'd been waiting for. No, she said when she got a breath. You're the bad apple.
The explosion was a lot louder than we had expected. Dad just gazed dumbfounded at the sight of our next-door neighbor's tree as it burst into flames.
Prints, lace, underwire, minimal padding, convertible straps, a built-in CD player, and one that made me look like Dolly Parton's little sister.
Tales from the South, Saturday afternoon at 3:30 on KUAF.
Indicted is a term meaning accused or to be brought to trial. In her book, The Indicted South, Public Criticism, Southern Inferiority, and the Politics of Whiteness, Angie Maxwell focuses on the impact that public criticism has had on white Southern identity over time, with repercussions still existing today. She argues that the explosion of mass media in the 1920s, much of which was targeted toward the South, shaped the way Southerners became defensive. She looks at three events in Southern history where the national criticism got really exacerbated. Maxwell recently stopped by the Carver Center for Public Radio to discuss her new book with Ozarks at Large's Christina Karnatz. Christina began by asking about one of these events, the 1925 Scopes trial,
which sees more media coverage than probably any trial in all of American history, including being covered on the front page of international papers, telegraph wire being laid to Hong Kong for the first time, just a complete media firestorm. And some of the coverage by, you know, wonderful writers like H.L. Mencken wasn't even of the community that was dealing with the trial. It actually was an outside community, and it gets kind of conflated, and it really gets, you know, The Nation, for example, called the trial Tennessee versus Civilization. And the New York Times said, you know, called the people in Dayton, Tennessee during that trial cranks and freaks on their front page. So even though there is a truth, or there was an ignorance that surrounded some of those people that were involved with the Scopes trial, or lack of education, the use of certain words and terminologies really created a defensiveness in the South that is still kind of causing problems today.
Wasn't it sort of not designed necessarily, but to draw media attention?
It totally was, but not to draw media attention the way they thought.
Just to the evolution issue.
Well, it was because they, you know, certain different companies had closed down in Dayton, Tennessee. Their population had dropped pretty dramatically, and a lot of people were suffering financially. And so when the ACLU took out an ad saying that they would, you know, where they want to see a trial, one or two local people in Dayton, one of them, George Rapelier, who wasn't from the South, who was a northern investor, thought it would be a good chance to, like, fill the hotels and, you know, fill the restaurants, and just had no idea, you know, what it would become when William Jennings Bryan and Clarence Darrow decide to come represent each side. It just, it took it to a level that they never expected or anticipated. I mean, they laid new, you know, train tracks because of the sheer volume of people that wanted to go there. And they didn't know, because they couldn't have predicted what was going to happen at the trial and the way William Jennings Bryan was going to falter on the stand in his interpretation of the Bible, and that he would die a few days after the trial and thence become a martyr and make the story even bigger, right? They had no idea the light in which they would have been cast and that the impact that it would have over time. So in the book, I look at these different moments when public criticism of the South was extremely intense, even when it was well-deserved, and what happens to those communities after that criticism, and trying to understand how all of that feeds how we understand Southern white behavior.
And you mentioned how there are repercussions even today of that. Just with this latest legislative session in Arkansas, we gained a lot, and I say we because we live in Arkansas and in the South. There was a lot of national attention for things that I personally think were negative. I mean, you know, gun rights issues and the 12-week abortion and things like that. I mean, I did. I got defensive.
Sure. Well, Southerners tend to... that us versus them mentality works in the South. It's an old psychological pattern, and politicians can use it for good and for bad, you know, depending on which way you look at certain issues. But there is kind of a chip, you know, on the Southern shoulder, so to speak, for that kind of national criticism. And like I said, some of it has been very well deserved, particularly some of the other cases I look at in terms of resistance to integration and so on. But being kind of cast as the, you know, the other in the American kind of story, or the exception, or the aberrant, you know, part of the country, has created those patterns of defensiveness. And I look specifically at the way in which it kind of creates a cultural kind of inferiority complex. And what you said about, you know, yourself feeling defensive, that's fine. You can feel defensive and you can manage those feelings of defensiveness. But there are groups and individuals who that really becomes so overwhelming that we see kind of a complex kind of arise. And that's when we see very irrational behavior, like I think some of the behavior you see in massive resistance to integration when we know integration is coming, the shutting down of schools, right? Those kinds of the denial of certain parts of history, right? It becomes really exacerbated. And usually that happens, and psychologists have found this, among communities that, you know, where there's a lack of education, there's poverty, and oftentimes kind of authoritarian religion. And when we see that a lot in the South, so that there's not a way to process that criticism. There's not a way to say, but we have all these great things, and it just becomes kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy of sort.
Well, that's the way I feel. Yeah, but they're only highlighting all these negative things, and there's so many good
things.
Because
you're part of a community that has a lot to feel proud of, and you can disassociate from this criticism and, oh, they're really not getting it, or they really exaggerated that, and here's all these great things. But for some communities, it becomes so consciousness raising that they can't really process it, and there's not other good things happening. And when there's not other good things happening, it can create kind of a backlash. And that's why I think we see, you know, Southern whiteness, you know, in its infancy or as it's being developed, that constructed, it's about race. Sure, it's about white versus black. That's how it starts in the South. You know, defining whiteness becomes that. But as it goes along, it becomes opposed to a whole bunch of other things like the federal government and science and expertise and, you know, all of these other things. And that's why it's kind of, I think, kind of like this intricate web now. And it can be set off or, you know, raised up if you trigger any of it, you know. And so very unusual things that we don't think are going to get people all up in arms, like climate change, becomes, you know, where Southern whites overwhelmingly deny it. existence. And we think, how did that happen? And if you really understand how Southern whiteness has been constructed, it makes perfect sense. Yeah, and so that's what the book's trying to kind of at a deeper level kind of unravel.
How, I mean, is there a way to change that mentality?
I think so. I mean, like I said, the original psychologist who coins the term inferiority complex was a man named Alfred Adler. And he was a contemporary of Freud. But Adler is the one that said, there's a couple of things you have to see this inferiority complex and the repercussions of it manifest in an individual. And I'm kind of loosely talking about it for a culture. You have to have a moment of consciousness. You have to have something come in to say you are less than. And then you have to be unable to deal with that. And like I said, education and authoritarian religion and poverty are the three things. So when we say education is the great equalizer, when we say education is the great uplifting, you know, thing that we should put all of our time and energy to, it's really true, because we do not see this happening as much when the education levels are higher in certain communities. We see that people understand complexity of public policy. They understand that just because it doesn't affect them, it's hurting somebody else. They tend to not react, you know, as in a reactionary way as dramatically as when we see that not happening. Also, when people are suffering financially, we know that there's increased violence and increased, you know, resistance to change and all of these kind of issues. We have to work on those things, and we have to try, you know, in Arkansas specifically, you know, we can, and the reason all of this whole story to me, this whole book, the reason why it still matters is because politicians have been very manipulative with it, to the point where we've got, you know, poor white Southerners in many cases voting against their economic self-interest because the us versus them
card is constantly
being played. But it can be played in another way. It can say, look at us, Arkansas. We expanded Medicaid. Look at us, Arkansas. We may have had a legislation that said that, you know, schools can, you know, choose to arm their, you know, teachers and staff, but every single school in the state opted out. Look at us, Arkansas. You can say there's an us, or we are not that. We are this. You know, come be on the side of progress and common sense and taking care of the least among us and all of those kind. We can champion that. We are not them. You know, we always say, like, we're not Mississippi, right? And people kind of smile about that, mm-hmm. and kind of laugh about that, but that's powerful, and it can be utilized by politicians on either side that have a progressive agenda to say Arkansas is better than all of those things, I think. And that resonates with people because that pattern is very old and well-established.
Well, you also look at literature.
I do.
It isn't just civil rights and politics and mm-hmm. and the media. It's also, you know, the South's place in literature and the way that people have written about it in fiction.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the case studies that I look at is the group of Southern writers that, you know, first called themselves the Fugitives. Then some of them kind of transformed into a group called the Agrarians, and then others still from that group became the New Critics. And I wanted to also look at people who had opportunity and had means and still kind of felt victim to this criticism, in a sense, and this group, and that the criticism transformed them, that it has that kind of power, is what I wanted to show in this pattern. And this group of writers, you know, they say this in their papers and in their letters back and forth to each other, you know, they become so disillusioned by the criticism that comes out of the Scopes trial initially that they become very politically involved. And they write the very famous 1930 collection, I'll Take My Stand, in which they defend Southern agrarianism. And that book is pretty much universally panned by critics when it comes out. And it doesn't get them, so much so they're kind of shocked. And really among the elite literary, you know, circles that they aspire to belong to. And so we see slowly over the course of a few years, this same group pull away completely from politics and engagement and start a school of literary criticism called the New Criticism. And I'm not saying it's the only reason they delve into New Criticism, but at its core, New Criticism, very simplified here, says we don't have to know all the biographical information about an author. We don't have to worry about all that context. It's the verbal icon. It's the word on the page. You know, it's the art. And that's very convenient if you're being panned by critics and you want to somehow kind of shed your Southern skin. And these guys do exactly that. And so there's a metamorphosis that comes as a way of processing this criticism. And then they decide, okay, we're now going to be the judge of what is literature and what is not. They put themselves in kind of that position. And when Alfred Adler sketched out the inferiority complex, he said that there's really kind of three compensations that people will make when suffering from this. The first is that they will seclude themselves. They will go into isolation. They will literally withdraw from the society that deems them less than. Or they will criticize somebody else as being inferior to make themselves feel superior. Or they will change the rules by which you're being judged. And in each of these cases I look at, we see a culture, a community, a whole group of people kind of perform those compensations. Now it's messy to take an individual diagnosis and apply to a culture, and you really can't, but you can sketch out the pattern. And in an effort to say this criticism has affected Southern whites dramatically and is at the root of a lot of these kind of key moments in Southern history.
You study the South, mm-hmm. yet the entire United States as a whole has a rich history and stuff. So why devote yourself to just one region?
It's a great question. I mean, you can't really understand the South unless you look at it within the nation at large. And that's been kind of a debate within Southern studies, which is, you know, do you kind of close yourself off and say, I look within the borders, or do you look at the relationship between the region and what it says about the country at large? And for me, the dynamics between the two have to be understood in all of their complexity. But the reason the political culture, which I think at its core is kind of what this book leads to, is so interesting to me is because prior to really like the 1940s, anytime somebody wrote a big analysis of American politics, there was usually kind of like a little asterisk that would say, or a footnote somewhere that would say, this applies to the country minus the 11 states of the former Confederacy, because things just political behaviors and institutions just didn't function down here like they did everywhere else until a man named V.O. Key got a grant from the Rockefeller Foundation to go down and do a big analysis of what is going on down the South. And that book, Southern Politics and State and Nation, really launches the field of Southern politics. And he's trying to understand why it has behaved differently. Now, he does, you know, maps and quantitative analysis and voting rights, all these kind of things, and that's fine. But underneath it really is a distinct culture, a distinct agriculture, climate, you know, history, religious affiliation, all of it, that creates this subculture within the country at large. And yet, when you look at presidential elections over the 20th century, it has been extremely influential as a voting block for the Democrats for a long time and now for the Republicans. And so it casts this great influence. It seems to lag behind the rest of the country on a lot of very important issues, and we have to understand why. And it's where all the immigration is coming in, which is also means we're going to see diversification at rapid levels. So it is kind of a laboratory, the South, in a weird way. And I think through studying it, not only do you learn about this region from, you know, where I grew up, but it explains a lot about America, too.
I wish we could break away from it.
You know, it's coming. Yeah. It's coming.
All right.
You know, Barack Obama in 2008 and 2012 is the first Democrat in the modern era to win without having to win a single Southern state. Now, he wins some Southern states, but he didn't have to. And that is a big difference. You know, that's a different animal altogether. In some ways, it makes the Republican Party very dependent on the South, but it doesn't make both parties dependent on the South, which was the way it was for a long time. Mm-hmm. So we'll see.
All right. Thanks, Angie.
No problem.
Angie Maxwell is the Diane D. Blair Professor of Southern Studies and Assistant Professor of Political Science in the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences. She is also the author of The Indicted South, Public Criticism, Southern Inferiority, and the Politics of Whiteness, New Directions in Southern Studies. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Christina Karnatz.
From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansas Songs.
There's a lady who's sure all that glitters is gold, and she's buying a stairway to heaven. And when she gets there, she knows if the stars are closed, with a word she can get what she came for.
Whoa, 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 and she's buying a stairway to heaven.
Southwest Little Rock-born percussionist and singer Joe Cripps has taken his congas around the world. Along the way, he's recorded with members of R.E.M. and met Fidel Castro while in Cuba. Cripps has worked with such influential Arkansas artists as Gun Bunnies, Jubilee Dive, Magic Crop Dusters, Jim Dickinson, and C.Dale Davis.
You actually kind of have a role to play in your community, too. You got to be the community musician, you know? You got to play the weddings. You got to play the funerals. You got to play the birthdays. You got to play the bar mitzvahs. You got to play when people need music.
Everyone beneath the sun is dreaming dreams, scheming schemes, wanting what they haven't got, chasing golden bees. I'm like the rest, it's quite true. Sweetheart, I want something too.
One of Joe Cripps' longer-lasting band affiliations was with Brave Combo, led by Texarkana native Carl Finch. Formed in 1979, Brave Combo's stock and trade has often been in the rarefied air of polka rock. Pulaski County native Cripps officially joined as percussionist in 1992 and played through 1999, although he played with the band before and after. Brave Combo has recorded with Japanese Ondo singing sensations, has such high-profile fans as Simpsons creator Matt Groening, but one of the band's strangest encounters must have been with the hippie-era falsetto singing and ukulele-playing sensation Tiny Tim.
People ask me about him a lot, and everyone says, oh, he was so strange to see on television or whatever. Was he really like that? And I always say the same thing. Yeah, that and more. I mean, TV could not capture the unique individual that Tiny Tim was. You know, it was not an act.
When it's springtime in the Rockies, I am coming back to you, little sweetheart of the mountains, with your bonny eyes of blue.
Born in 1932, Tiny Tim burst onto the American consciousness in the late 1960s and briefly was a media curiosity. He appeared with Johnny Carson, Ed Sullivan, and on Laugh-In, and landed a record deal with Reprise Records. Tiny's remake of Tiptoe Through the Tulips became an unlikely rock chart hit. His marriage in December 1969 on TV's Tonight Show drew tens of millions of viewers and produced a daughter named Tulip. He performed before hundreds of thousands at the Isle of Wight Festival in 1970.
Surprisingly old-fashioned in a lot of ways. He was an old-fashioned guy, an old-fashioned romantic.
And now the purple dust of twilight time steals across the meadows of my heart. Now the little stars pine, always reminding me that we're apart.
He was a one-of-a-kind individual. He's a great artist and was a great educational resource. He knew more old songs than anyone, you know, a certain time period of music from the late 1800s through the mid 1900s, even to the late 1900s. He had memorized all of this material. In fact, at one time, held the Guinness Book of World Records of most songs sung from memory back to back. He was just an encyclopedia of this stuff.
The Tiny Tim with Brave Combo album, Girl, was released on Rounder Records in 1996. Several years passed during the recording of the release, Carl Finch explained, because they didn't want it to be written off as a novelty record. Tiny Tim and Brave Combo recorded such rock-era classics as Stairway to Heaven and Hey Jude, but also included more obvious older songs like Bye Bye Blackbird and Stardust.
He knew all of the people who had sung those songs originally and could imitate them. And would tell you, he was very much a documentarist in his own way. He would always want to tell you whatever he was about to sing, all he knew about it. This was recorded for so-and-so, like it's from this musical from this year, starring so-and-so. He'd tell you all about it. And I'll sing it like, you know, Rudy Valley.
Hey, Juice, don't make it bad. Take a sad song and make it better.
Tiny Tim died November 30th, 1996, the same year Girl was released. Tiny died soon after collapsing on stage in Minneapolis. He had been performing his signature hit, Tiptoe Through the Tulips.
He could kind of psychedelic out a little bit and be a laugh-in or do Tiptoe Through the Tulips or whatever, and it just seemed like it was from outer space and it fit right in. But at heart, he was an old romantic songster.
Here in its entirety is That Old Feeling from the 1996 album Girl by Tiny Tim with Brave Combo, featuring Little Rock's Joe Cripps on percussion and vocals.
I saw you last night and got that old feeling. When you came inside, I got that old feeling. The moment you came by, I felt a thrill. And when you caught my eye, my heart stood still. Once again I seemed to have an old yearning, and I knew the spark of love was still burning. There'll be no new romance for me. It's foolish to start, for that old feeling is still in my heart.
I saw you last night
and got that old feeling.
When you came inside,
I got that old feeling. The moment you came by, I felt a thrill. And when you caught my eye, my heart stood still. Once again I seemed to have that old yearning, and I knew the spark of love was still burning. There'll be no new romance for me. It's foolish to start, for that old feeling is still in my heart.
That Old Feeling by Tiny Tim with Brave Combo with Little Rock's Joe Cripps from the 1996 album Girl. It's another song of Arkansas. From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
Arkansongs is a production of FM 89 and Experiment Station Studios. For more information or to subscribe to the podcast, visit arkansongs.org.
Ozarks at Large is supported by the Center for Arkansas and Regional Studies at the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville, dedicated to the celebration and documentation of this region's history and culture. A listener-supported service of the Department of Journalism and Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, Centerton. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Thanks so much for listening. Tune in tomorrow at noon for an all-new edition of Ozarks at Large. I will be back along with my co-host, Kyle Kellums. And remember, you can catch up on old episodes of the show at our website, ozarksatlarge.com. Thanks again for listening, and I hope your week is off to a fantastic start.